Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome back our Evolving to Exceptional listeners to this week's episode, where we have Dr. Anne Welsh with us here today. She started her career at Harvard and began really focusing on, and this is why I really think she's a great guest for us today, focusing on how she works with parents in particular across different careers, but specifically in the healthcare and STEM space is where she began, to really focus on how to do that well and how to focus on how to be a working parent, which is quite the challenge, as I know personally from being a working parent and mom of three. And I'd love for you to just tell us a little bit about how you got into the space that you're in and why it is you do what you do. What is it that really energizes you and makes you passionate about this area of focus?
Yeah, thanks so much for the introduction. And short version, I'm a working mom of four, so I live the experience. But a little longer background, I wanted to be a doctor from a very early age. My mother was a doctor, which when I was a child was pretty rare, actually, to have not only a full-time working mother, but to have a mother in STEM. And so I think I wanted to be her basically when I grew up. And she also had four kids. And I got all the way to getting into medical school, and something in me said, no, this isn't quite right. This isn't quite what you want to be doing. And so I took a little bit of a pivot and I ended up going into psychology. And I worked for many years and still do as a clinical psychologist. And that's been the basis for my work. My research was separately, interestingly, in the transition to motherhood and in career development. So I wasn't combining them. I wasn't looking at those as overlapping areas. I was looking at them as very kind of two lines of research that I was doing. And I will say that even despite doing that research, it really doesn't prepare you for the experience of working parenthood. It's been more challenging, I think, than I would have anticipated it to be. But anyway, I did research for a while. I was working at Harvard, and then I had my second of my four kids. And at that point, I decided to make another shift and started my own private practice. And since then, have really been focusing on supporting mothers, women in general, women's leadership development, women's career development. And so I do both executive coaching and the clinical and therapy piece. But all of that tends to be around working with mothers and women's health concerns and things like that.
So let's start with what's really important, which is, how old are your kids?
Good question. So they are, my youngest is 7, almost 8, and then my oldest is 14. So I've got kids in elementary school, middle school, and now high school as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. My son is 7, almost 8. So similar age range. And then I have twin 4-year-old girls, the spread there. So I'm curious what it was that really drew you into, or what was that motivating factor to begin really focusing on mothers and that parenting and that, and how to navigate kind of those challenges? What is it that kind of moved you more into that space or drew you to that space?
Yeah, my research had focused there because I was really interested in transition points. And so I think one of the questions that has always been fascinating to me is how we navigate things when our environment radically changes. And so I really liked working with college students and that transition to college and that transition to your first job, right? That all of these points where there is a notable identity shift and a notable potentially environmental shift. And so with the transition to motherhood, I think that's all of the above rolled into one. And at the time that I was doing the research, it was really understudied. And so that was just another kind of interesting area, right? There was a lot of rich data that I could get that hadn't been looked at before. And I found that when I was doing this research, I did a number of studies throughout grad school, participants were really eager to talk because nobody was asking them what this was like. And so I just got really immersed in it from very early on. And then my own transition to motherhood looked different with each kid. But again, there was always this piece of kind of fascination with it of, wow, how come it's different with each kid? What is that about me that changes? What it is about my job that's changed? What is it about the kid themselves and their unique temperament that has made this particular one different from the kids before. So there's definitely been that kind of curiosity piece to it. And the other piece that's really driven it, as I was practicing, in particular in the kind of clinical psychology space, I found a lot of women were struggling with this piece of how do I do both? And that's when I started to also shift into executive coaching and saying, can I support women from all sides? And can I work with corporations to make them working parent friendly so that there isn't such the struggle of how do I do both?
So tell me a little bit, I'm curious about what some of your research findings were as you were diving into that, as you were looking at that. Was there any definitive conclusions or insights that you gained from looking at that, from having those conversations with different working mothers in particular?
Yeah, I was looking at a couple different variables over time. But so one of the really consistent findings is, and then this is true, actually, I should say across almost any study that includes it, is the value of social support and the value of other people. And in the case of mothers, that of your partner, but also of peers, right? Like having other women go through this with you. And I think sometimes we end up feeling really alone. And one of the things I've seen since COVID, in particular with mothers of younger children, is that they didn't have a lot of the camaraderie because they couldn't, having kids during COVID. And that's continued, right? Like they've almost continued to feel isolated or struggle to find peers or other women that get it. So that was piece number one. And I think the other piece that I found was that a lot of women were struggling with just coping tools in general, not having like the access to them, access to coping tools that were working for them, and not having the ability to come up with ones that worked for them, or that what used to work before having kids maybe isn't accessible after having kids. And so there was this need to rewrite the script of how we manage stressors. And then the big one I think that I'm constantly talking about with clients is also changing our expectations and using that as a way to decrease the stress and ease that transition, that a lot of kind of perfectionism or over the top expectations, both from internally and from externally. So what is culture saying that a good mother is, and really needing to fight against those rules and come up with our own experience of what it is to be a good mother and to tolerate imperfection and mistakes and not, quote, doing it all.
So I love that when you talk about expectations, and I've got a real kind of real world example, and this is something I've struggled with as a mom for sure, is I'm not a great magical moment capturer of pictures, right? Everybody puts up these great, the things. You go to the apple picking or the pumpkin picking and the Halloween picture, and you've got all these milestone pictures, and I'm just terrible at remembering to take those. And so we took our kids to the pumpkin patch this past weekend. We actually spent a whole day at multiple different fall festivals. End of the day, I realized I never took any pictures of the kids doing anything in particular because I was so busy playing with them and picking out the pumpkins with them and looking at and doing all the things. I wasn't putting them into poses to take pictures. And that's one of the expectations I've had to let go of for myself of, okay, I'm not a Facebook mom or a mom that puts up, and I'm not actually negating what anyone else does in that space. It's just not something that comes naturally to me. And so I'm just not going to expect that of myself. So I'm not going to make myself feel bad that I failed to do that, or I didn't do something like that, because that's not critical necessarily.
Totally. And I think what you just said is so important, right? It's not about what I think other people should do either, right? I think motherhood is one of these spaces where no matter what you do, you're going to be doing it differently than someone else. And someone on the internet is going to tell you you're doing it wrong, right? Like the stakes are so high and the pressure so high that people get really dogmatic, I think, sometimes about how they're doing it as a way to make themselves maybe feel okay. And in the end, there's so many different ways that we can mother that are fine, right? That are great for our kids. There's a lot of value in doing it differently and in finding the way that fits for you, right? And acknowledging that this is what's best for me and my temperament and my personality and my unique sets of circumstances and my unique children. And that has no bearing on how other people are mothering. It's not a judgment call for them or for me. And I have to accept that and be okay with that. And when I can do that, I'm actually going to be happier as a mom.
I think it's such a powerful lesson for people. And when we talk about it from like a neuroscience lens, which is our theme, and we look at it that way, I always talk about it's our unique neural pathways. And so what works for one of my children's neural pathways doesn't work for another of my children's. What works for my sister doesn't work for me. What works for me doesn't work for her and her family and her kids. And I think we do end up as parents getting into, and I'm not sure where it comes from, but some belief that there's a right way and there's a wrong way versus that there's these multiple different ways and they can all be right at the same time, that they're not necessarily negating, or if my way's right, someone else's way has to be wrong of mentality. Have you seen that? And how do you help people navigate or deal with those beliefs?
Yeah, no, I think I see that all the time. And I see it, and not just even in, I think, mothering world. I think especially for those of us that are high achievers, we grow up and somewhere along the line, we get the message that different is bad, that there's one right way to do it. And I think almost I have to go for the A in parenting, if you will, right? And to get an A on a math test, yeah, there is one right way, right? There's one right answer. But that's not the case in the rest of our lives. But we've spent so much of our lives in that mentality. It's really hard to shift that mindset. And I call it the ambitious identity paradox, right? Like we keep going after the next best thing, thinking that's going to be the thing that makes us fulfilled. And in the end, it's making us unhappy because we're getting further and further from like our own internal compass. And with moms, a lot of it is stripping back. Okay, here's what you think a good mother is. Is that real? Right? Is that even something you actually value? What is it doing to you and your relationship with your kid is to reach for it? And then what are your actual values? What's a different way to be? And how can you tolerate that maybe not everyone's going to be that way, right? Not that they disagree with you, although they might, but that you're going to find something unique instead that fits better.
So I'm curious, we hit on this a little bit about the, you mentioned the COVID and some of the lasting effects of that, especially for young moms. I'm curious a little bit about what are some of the common things that you're hearing and whether there's been a change from what you were experiencing before COVID and what you're experiencing now after COVID in working with your clients and the folks that you, the parents that you're working with.
Yeah, I think the biggest COVID-related changes I saw were, A, that sense of isolation that we mentioned. Previous to COVID, you could do a lot of activities with other kids. Even something as simple as I practice leaving the house to go to the grocery store with my infant. And then people were having babies in COVID and you couldn't even do that. So they never leave the house with their kid until their kid's two. And then it's hard because leaving the house with a two-year-old is hard, but you expect yourself to be able to do it easily, but you've had no practice. So how, of course it's going to be a struggle, right? And so a lot of anxiety and people beating themselves up about having to do these things as like new things when their kids are slightly older because they didn't have the access to it during COVID. The other big thing I've seen is that people who had kids during COVID is currently struggling with working parent life as a lot more companies are going back in person and shifting their policies around that. I'm finding that working parents, really of any kids' ages, but particularly those younger kids where they didn't have a pre-COVID parenthood to compare it to, are really struggling with, my life is not built around an hour commute or around going in or around having to leave for that 5 p.m. daycare pickup. And I don't know how to make this work. And they're either leaving for a more flexible company or they're staying, but they're miserable and they've got a foot out the door and are trying to figure out some way to stay afloat.
What do you think is different, or what have you observed is different? For, is it just that their lived experience is different? Or do you feel like there's something that's different across the board for folks that is causing them maybe more frustration or struggle today than they did before COVID?
That's a great question. And it's probably all of the above. I think that there is a, I think part of it is that we saw that we could do a lot of stuff remotely during COVID. And so there is this sense of why are we arbitrarily going back to the way things were if that doesn't actually change my ability to do my job. And a lot of frustration, understandably, with I'm going back to be in person, but I'm spending my whole day on Zoom. So why am I here? And so a sense of it doesn't make sense from policy level, from a personnel level, and I really am unhappy with the upheaval to the rest of my life to accommodate this kind of push to go back when I'm not seeing any value in it. So I think there's that. I also think there may be a bit of a generational thing where the people who are having kids now are in this millennial generation, as opposed to pre-COVID, more Gen X generation were the ones having kids. And I know I'm speaking in huge generalizations, but I think there is maybe a shift in how the different generations even think about work or think about the rules or what's required. And there's probably some of that too.
I think you're right. I think the other thing I've noticed, and it took me a while to actually notice that this, even though I am a mom who's impacted by these things, but is that childcare, there's a huge shortage of childcare providers. And you know what, my children's school used to stay open until 7. Now it closes at 5:30. So pre-COVID, it was open much longer than it is now. My son's in public school. The aftercare programs have wait lists on them. And we're blessed because we are able, my husband and I do work from home. He's in sales and I do this. So my son could come home on the bus at 4:15 and we're here. We can keep working until the end of the day without, it doesn't disrupt us for him to come home and get a snack and go back out. He usually goes back out and rides his bike with friends or whatever. But if you've got to be in the office, then you've got kids either they're going to come home to an empty house, or it makes things, I think, a lot more complicated. And I'm not sure those with older kids know about some of those changes that have happened for families. The other thing I noticed was around health, what like sick policies of schools and kids getting, being able to go back or having to get a doctor's note before going back and things like that, that have made all of that just a whole lot more complicated than at least I remember it being before COVID.
Yes, I 100%, right? I think you make such a good point that A, there's that shift in childcare, but B, around the decision makers versus the ones impacted by it. And again, this is, maybe it's generational, maybe it's age, but if I'm the senior attorney at a law firm and I'm making these policies, chances are I'm older and my kids are older. And honestly, chances are I might have had a spouse that was at home with my kids. Right. And so I don't, maybe in that mentality, take into consideration the fact that the vast majority are now in dual wage earner homes. So you've got both parents working, and that it's a lot different when your kids are little than when they're older.
So the other thing I'm curious about, I'm curious what you've seen with this, is there's so much talk of, and I have friends with older age kids who are struggling with some of the mental health issues that we're seeing. The rates are incredibly high, especially for teenage girls as it relates to our middle school and teenage girls, as it relates to suicide and depression rates, and rates of suicide are higher than they've ever been for children. I'm curious how you're seeing that also impact parents, and they're trying to balance workplace expectations with some of those other challenges that maybe are newer.
Yeah, I was just, there's been a couple recent articles around this, both from the perspective of needing the time off to get these appointments, which is really challenging, needing the time off to care for your kids, and then needing the benefits that cover it. So there's like, I think there's like a three-pronged impact on parents around this. You've seen these kind of skyrocketing mental health needs for everybody post COVID, right? And again, I can speak to that as a clinician, where there's far more people than I can ever serve that are asking for my services simply because I'm one person and I can't take all of that on as much as I would like to. So there's a lot more need. And as a parent, it is this really complicated thing because you need to find someone that A, sees kids, and that's not easy, period, the first step. Then you need to figure out how you're going to get that kid to the appointment. And in general, kids do better in person. You can sometimes do Zoom, but they do, especially the younger kids, do better in person. And then you need to figure out how you're going to pay for it. So you've got time, you've got resources. And then on top of that, there's just the mental weight of my kid is struggling. And that's one more thing that I'm dealing with as a parent.
And I wonder too, how acceptable it is. And I don't know the answer to this, but in workplaces to raise those issues or to talk about that or to admit that to your boss or the folks in your workplace so that they have that awareness. I can imagine that there may be some struggle with openly talking about those types of challenges.
Yeah, I think it totally varies workplace to workplace. And one of the things that I try to push and to support from a consulting angle is creating a culture of care where this stuff is safe, right? And I think psychological safety is a buzzword these days. And a lot of companies like to talk about creating it, but it's one thing to say we value our employees, and it's a whole nother thing to say we actually support them in their own mental health needs and taking care of that and in supporting the needs of their children, and that it's, you know, okay to schedule time off to take your kids to a doctor's appointment, be that with a therapist or with a physician.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I'm curious, what is some of the direction you provide companies around supporting and retaining those working parents? What are some of the things companies and workplaces can do to really make a difference for their employees, for their people, in order to ensure that they're performing at their best and they're getting what they are, you know, wanting out of their people?
Yeah, and I make a lot of suggestions. And the number one that I always start with is trying to create a culture of respect and trust. If I often say, if you want something done, get a working parent to do it, because they will get it done, right? They know that they only have so much time, and they will put in the time when they have it and get it done. They want to perform well. Sometimes that means working at weird hours because that's when they can. Sometimes that means they don't get to something at X time, but they get to it at Y time. And so along with that culture of respect and trust that your workers do want to get their stuff done comes the flexibility around maybe hours worked, around where the work is done, around how the work is done, having the technology to support asynchronous work. Typically, I see a lot of working parents that, like, yeah, they have to leave because they have that daycare pickup at 5. But most of them are signing back on and working then after bedtime for a few hours, that they want to have that evening to spend with their children, but they will get the stuff done afterwards. Or where one parent will start work really early so that they can be there at the end of the day. And I start work at 7:30 in the morning so that I'm done at the end of the day with my kids pretty early. And my spouse starts work at 9 more often than not, but then works much later. And so allowing parents to find that balance that works for them and having the expectation that they're going to get the work done. The other pieces I talk about a lot are creating that culture of gender equality around parenting. And that includes having really good parental leave policies that's gender neutral. I could spend an hour talking about the data on why it's important for men and fathers to take parental leave too. It's good for their mental health. It's good for mom's mental health. It's good for kids' mental health, right? There's all sorts of stuff around it. But more importantly, it sets the tone from the beginning that dad's involvement matters and that dads are parents too, which then allows both mothers and fathers to participate in childcare. It can help things stay more equal in the home in terms of who's doing the majority of the childcare labor, of the mental load. And then that can also translate into more equity in the workplace. There's, again, been some data coming out where around the wage gap, obviously we just saw the Nobel Prize around that in econ, which was exciting to see it awarded. But one of the ways that we can fight against that is having gender neutral leave. And then I also advocate for sponsoring coaching around your parent, working parents, around their parental leave coaching in particular, so that you help parents come back in. But providing executive coaching to your working parents in general just says, hey, we value you. We want to help you grow into leadership positions. We want to hone the skills that you have, like that we want you around.
So you hit on a lot there, and I want to hit back up on a few different things. One is, I love what you talked about with parental leave. I remember when I had my son, my husband took 2 weeks off to be at home, and it was so impactful. And I'm a big research neuroscience guru person. And so I did all this research and understood that the statistical outcomes for children are so much greater if the fathers stay home in those first couple of weeks, because the fathers get over that learning curve, right? Of how to change the diaper, how to deal with things, that if they go back to work, they don't have that same bonding experience. And so they're less involved all throughout than if they're there. And I almost immediately went back, and our workplace got parental leave, 2 weeks parental leave for dads. I would love to see it be longer than that, but at least those first few weeks that are just so hard for new moms, new parents to navigate. So I love that you talked about that. And then going back to the psychological safety component, what we think of, or when we talk about it through the multiple brains, or we talk about the neural networks that are in our gut brain, and that there's this safety response or this intuition that comes from our gut brain that's pretty well researched at this point around how that can trigger the fight, flight, freeze, different type of responses based upon the situation that people are in. And you talked about the trust and respect. And I would love if you could just speak a little bit around how do workplaces create that environment for these parents, for their people, in a way that really works, in a way that really leads to the outcome versus it just being like the buzzword that you talked about?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is that flexibility and trust. And again, not just saying we trust you to get your work done, but actually trusting that they're getting their work done. Again, there's some decent data that micromanaging actually typically backfires, right? Where the more we hone down on the rules, the more people find ways to break them, right? We think of that as like a teenage trait, and as someone with a 14-year-old at home, like I definitely see that. But I think that's true throughout life. And so that if we assume people won't do it unless we tamp down on them, we take away a lot of their kind of internal intrinsic motivation. And then we create the self-fulfilling prophecy where maybe they're not doing the work, or they are trying to skirt the rules because the rules don't fit and don't make any sense. And so we want to do the opposite, right? And start from a place of trust with more flexibility and more room for people to do, again, what works for them. And then they'll want to do the work and they'll show up and it will get done and it will create a positive feedback loop. The other piece that I like to speak to, and this touches on the neural networks piece. So when you have a child, and this is true of birth mothers and fathers and non-birthing parents, your brain primes itself for learning. It is another huge period evolutionarily, biologically, for neural growth and connection. You are primed to pick up more kind of empathy skills, like reading other brains and other people, because you have to do that as a parent, right? So there's this huge learning period, and it actually contributes to not just learning as a parent, but it contributes to skills that are really valuable in the workplace. And I think if workplaces could get around this, they'd see, wow, or get their heads around it, they'd see how important working parents are and what the value they bring. So I talk about the four P's of leadership lessons from parenting, and I can go into them. They're all of these wonderful skills that we have to develop as parents that we then bring into the workplace. And if our employers can see that's happening, then everyone's going to value those working parents, and that's going to be felt on both the employers and the employees' sides. I talked about empathy, but like one of the P's is people skills. So emotional intelligence, communication, right? obviously those kind of soft skills, you have to be able to use those as a parent to understand and support your kid. And those are exactly what we want our leaders to have at work, right? Another one is processing skills. So things like being decisive, prioritizing, being adaptable, right? When you have a kid, you're learning so much and processing so much so quickly, you have to get really good at this processing skill piece. The third one is productivity. Again, I said, if you want something done, give it to a working parent, because you learn to get stuff done. When you have 5 minutes, something gets done, right? And part of that is also being really patient and being willing to go with the process, right? As you have 4-year-olds at home that are twins, getting toddlers to do anything is an exercise in patience, right? Mm-hmm. And so we translate that patience to our workplaces as well, as we're more able to hold a boundary and let things happen the way they need to happen. And then the last one is just, I call it perspective taking and planning, but it's really that mental load thing that we talk about a lot as parenting, prioritizing, yes, but also anticipating needs, multitasking, like project management, right? I like to use the example of, you know, whether it's going to the park or the beach with your kids, right? You have to know, all right, when is nap time? Because we have to be home for nap time or they're going to melt down. I need to have water. I need to have snacks. Maybe the snacks should be allergen free in case there's other kids at the park with allergies. Is it sunny? Do we need sunscreen? Is it going to rain? Do we need raincoats? How am I going to get this all there? And when do I start giving my kids the warning that we're leaving so they all come willingly rather than in a football carry of a tantrum? It's a huge mental task that you have to do that. We want people who can do that at work too, right? Who can say, all right, what are the projects we're needing to do? What is the client going to need? How can I anticipate that need ahead of time and maybe even fix it before it's a problem? And how do I think big picture and small scale tasks at the same time?
So go back over those four again. It's performance.
Let's see. Well, we're trying people skills,
people
processing skills, productivity skills, and perspective taking.
People skills, processing, productivity, and perspective taking.
Yes.
I think it's so incredibly valuable to think about it that way. And I love those categories. And a lot of the training that we do around neuroperformance, we apply our trainings, actually the skills, into both spaces. So when we're training people on the skills that you need to be at optimum performance in the workplace, it's actually the same skill that you can then use at home. And people actually develop their neural pathways faster if they're using the skill in both places. And so it's the same, or it really is the same concept, right? That if you have people intentionally focused on and you're recognizing the value of these skills that they're developing, these four P's that you highlight in their parenting and what they're getting as parents, that is all going to be able to be applied in the workplace, especially if you can create the connection to see how, if I've got these skills and I'm doing this here, now how do I apply that as I go back to work? How do I recognize this, the empathy that I now have, or the connection that I now have, or I've experienced or seen with my kids, and then bring that back to my relationships as a manager in the workplace or as a person in the workplace? I love that.
Yeah. And I think that's where I advocate, if a company can, that coaching can come in really handy to help translate those two environments together and help parents see, wow, I am really making all these strides. Because I think sometimes parents themselves feel like I'm failing across the board, right? I'm not quite doing enough at work. I'm not quite home enough to, or as much as I'm supposed to be. And the reality is, you're learning and you're growing and you're doing great at both, right? You don't see it when you're in it, but I think coaching can really help reach across those two worlds to help parents hold how much they are doing and how much they are contributing.
Yeah. One of the things I love to say is, no matter where you go, your body goes with you. And so understanding how to hone that performance of your body wherever you're performing, whether it's in your role as parent at home or whether it's in your role in the workplace, understanding yourself and those skills and applying those skills. And I love the idea of having that coach who then can make those connections. I think that's really powerful for people. So tell us a little bit about your coaching programs and about how you support parents specifically, not necessarily making recommendations for workplaces, but what you do with those parents to help them navigate those challenges.
Yeah. And so I do it. I have two forms. I do individual coaching and I do group coaching as well. And so, but really in either case, and in my individual coaching, it's not even always with parents, but it is this process of A, figuring out what are the messages that aren't working for me around what a leader is supposed to be, around what an employee is supposed to be, around what a parent is supposed to be, if the individual is a parent, and picking apart, where did I get those messages? Is there cultural things at play, my family, misogyny? I work primarily with women, not always. What are the kind of gender roles that are enforcing these lessons? And we pick them apart so that we can get rid of these old models that aren't working anymore. And then we start tapping into what are your values and what are your strengths, and as a way to start figuring out what is going to work. And a big part of that is, what do you want? Because I think so many of us stopped asking that question a very long time ago, right? Whether it's as simple as, what do I want for dinner? Or what do I want to do with my life? There's so many of us that have turned off, what do I want? Or what works for me? And then we start crafting a new model, right? Based on those unique factors of, okay, what is leadership going to look like for me? If I'm just inherently more introverted, my leadership is not going to look the same as someone that's super extroverted. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't have to be one way. And if I try to lead from this other way, if I try to lead from a place where it doesn't fit, I'm going to be uncomfortable all the time. I'm probably going to be unfulfilled. That kind of inauthentic version of me is just never going to fit quite right. And so we've got to find that version that fits, that does work, that you feel aligned with. And then there's a lot of practicing new behaviors, right? Because you can read about it, you can listen to this podcast, right? But you have to actually have some practice with those behaviors to create those new neural pathways, right? I use the analogy of sledding. I'm in Boston. We have lots of snow. If you're sledding down a hill, if you've sled down the same hill 3 million times, there's usually like a good worn path. And if you put your sled at the top, you're going to just go down that path again. And we have to practice like picking up the sled and moving it over to a new spot to start creating those new pathways, right? And so there is a lot of practicing of new behaviors involved, even if they feel scary or just different from how you used to do it. And that once you have some practice under your belt, those new pathways will start to feel like the well-worn ones.
Yeah. And I think what's helpful, or what's been helpful for me in thinking that way, and I love your analogy with the sled, is recognizing that when you've had a pathway for a really long time and you've operated a certain way, maybe your whole life, that creating that new pathway isn't going to be a one-time, I got it. Because the natural way, and I use sand in the sandbox and the pathway, and if you pour the water in, it's going to go the way that's easiest. It's going to flow to the place that's easiest for it to flow. And so if this is a brand new pathway, maybe a little bit starts to go that way, but not, it's not going to be fully formed yet. And so I think that's where, and what I found, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is I found that often when that new path isn't working, there's something that isn't lined up for the person yet. There's something where the person hasn't, there's something internal that's actually resisting that pathway, and they haven't really aligned themselves on either that they want it or that it's good and safe and the right path for them, or is it aligned with who they are, or do they think it's a good decision from an analytical or a head-based perspective? There's something that's preventing them from taking that new path. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's where some of the traditional kind of leadership classes really fall short, because they do, just like we were talking about with motherhood, right? Like they do present it as, here's what you need to do. You need to network. You need to speak up in meetings. You need to post on LinkedIn, whatever the advice is. And maybe typically, I would say the person, like you said, who is maybe not doing that particular thing is not doing it for a reason. And we've got to figure out the reason. so that they can do it, right? Because maybe the reason is they're scared. Maybe the reason is really valid. Maybe it's, this isn't a safe environment in which to do it because it's a toxic workplace. And so we actually need to get you into a different workplace before you can even do that behavior. But maybe the reason is it just doesn't fit. And I need to try something else that actually does fit that will meet the same goal down the road. So there it's really important to have those steps of assessing, why am I doing this? And what do I want? What fits for me?
And I think often that is embedded into their subconscious. Often that there is something that forms there. And I'll use myself as an example, in that there was a lot for me as a new mom that was tied up in how much I accomplished was indicative of my worth. And I wasn't consciously aware of that. I wasn't thinking every day I have to get this much work done in the workplace or I'm not valuable. That wasn't like part of my conscious awareness, but it was an embedded belief that I wasn't even aware of, that was really, that ultimately is I think one of the factors that led me into my burnout experience. Because when you have kids, they require so much of you, especially when I had my twins, and they required a lot of me both at the same time. And you're no longer able to maybe produce as much the same way. And so for me, it was all quantity. It was how much. It wasn't necessarily what's the full value that you're bringing. And that was all tied into my worth. And until I dealt with that, I couldn't bring myself into a balanced state. I couldn't get myself into how do I make this work, because I had that embedded belief. And I found that it's usually down in somebody's physiology that's below their conscious awareness, that is usually the things that are standing in their way, not just in terms of parenting and living their great life, but also in terms of their performing in the ways that workplaces would want you to perform or mm-hmm. to get the results that you would want to get in the workplace.
Yeah, 100%, right? And I think it's because those are the beliefs that are a little bit like the water we're swimming in. They're so pervasive and they're so invisible. And I think that's a really common one. I am only worth what I can achieve. Or another really common one is I can't rest until I've accomplished enough or done, quote, enough to deserve it. And then that gets so tied into, again, with the working parent piece, where we really undervalue the work of parenting culturally, systemically. And so it isn't enough that you kept a human alive for the day. And when they're infants, it's not enough that all you got done was feeding this child and changing their diapers, because that's not important. That's not an achievement. So you don't deserve a break or a rest. And yet, anyone who's done those things can tell you they're real hard and you're exhausted by the end of the day. And if you don't take that rest, you will burn out and you will struggle because of it.
And it's not, I think, as I reflect on my own experience, it's not something you consciously control. And so that burnout, I love that you said you will burn out, because it's not if you will burn out, it's when you will burn out. Because when you are pushing yourself, and for me, when I had my twins, they had a food protein intolerance, so they couldn't take formula. I had to keep nursing my twins, and one of them wouldn't take a bottle even. She would go all day without taking a bottle. And so I was nursing twins around the clock for many months and trying to work and trying to be an executive leader working. And I couldn't get into the office often enough. I couldn't get there for long enough. My boss would ask me questions about that. I felt like I had to defend myself. It was just this constant state of stress. And I thought it was something I could power through, right? Like, I just have to get through this time. And the truth is that stress doesn't just suddenly go away and you're better again. And so so ultimately for me, it led to a pretty extreme burnout experience. And I think it's something that we as moms can underestimate, the drain on our bodies in trying to balance those things. And if we aren't doing the things to take care of ourselves, that we will end up in that state, that ultimately it will lead to that. And one of the challenges I had, and I would love for you to speak to as you're promoting getting that coaching support, is I think there's often this belief that I have to know how to do it on my own, that I shouldn't need help, that I shouldn't need support, like that, how come nobody else, everybody else figured this out on their own? I shouldn't need a coach. I shouldn't, why do I need that? How is that going to really help me? Is it worth the investment in coaching or in hiring someone to support me in that way? Because we think we have to go it alone. Is that something you've seen? And what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Again, I think that's part of that high achiever mentality, right? And many of us probably did as kids. I was totally that person that in a group project would do all the work, right? For everybody else, because I wanted it done well, and I'd rather do it than have to take a lower grade. But that gets, I think that kind of experience gets into our mentality of you have to do it. Nobody's going to show up to help you. And yet that's not true. And it's in fact impossible to do it without support. I think that's been one of the blessings, the learning areas for me personally of parenting is I've got to learn to ask for help and to take it. And to let people help. And I think that's really challenging. And that's one of the reasons I do group coaching as well, because I think it's so helpful to have, especially again, as working mothers, to have other working moms say, hey, me too. I'm also struggling. I'm in the weeds. This doesn't feel right to me. I don't know how to do this. I served my kids cereal all last week for dinner because I couldn't figure another way out, or I missed my kids' soccer game and he's mad because I had to work, or whatever it is, but that these things that we think everybody else has it figured out. We maybe know on some level everything on Instagram is fake, and yet we still see it and it still seeps in as that's how we're supposed to be. And so that group experience of support of other women who are saying, nope, you're definitely not alone, me too, can be incredibly valuable as we all go through this experience.
I love that I love that you say that, because I think sometimes we can't even figure out how other women have done it or how they're doing it, and it feels very alone, like I'm drowning and I'm suffocating over here. How are other people functioning and I'm not functioning? And so you feel like it's some sort of deficit or some sort of weakness or lack in yourself, rather than that the system itself is broken. And I like to use the analogy that oftentimes we think that we're broken. We're looking into a mirror and we think that we're broken, but the mirror is really what's broken. And so it's the reflection that's coming back at us that's broken, not us, not ourselves. And that we are actually doing, and I think most moms fall into the category of doing the absolute very best that they possibly can with the resources and knowledge and skills that they have, and almost never feel like it's enough, almost never feel like they're doing as much as they should be doing.
No, I think that's so true. And similarly, I'm always telling, whether it's my patients or my coaching clients or my groups, right? It's hard simply because it's hard. You're not doing it wrong. It's hard because it's hard. And you're also doing a great job, right? The fact that you're worried about it, the fact that you care so much is simply the nature of being a parent, right? You want your kids to be happy. And that's a pretty big burden to put on ourselves. And there is no such thing as a perfect mother. And there is no such thing as a perfect leader. You're going to make mistakes. And actually, that's a good thing for your kids, because you're modeling for them resiliency and self-compassion, if you can tolerate messing up and forgiving yourself for it.
Yeah, I find that can be really powerful for kids too, for you to be willing to say, I probably shouldn't have yelled just there. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I did that. That's not a good way to interact. And it teaches them how they can do that and how they can say, yeah, I made a bad choice. I messed up. My children's book is Good Choice, Bad Choice. So it's all about that there's not good or bad boys and girls. There's just good and bad choices, and separating the stigma from the choice. And I think that understanding really teaches a lot to kids as well. So I think it's valuable when parents can see that they don't need to be perfect in their kids' eyes. In fact, it helps their kids to know when they're struggling, to know, oh, mom's having a real bad day. That's why mom's crying. Mom had a rough day. And you know what? When we have rough days, sometimes we just need to cry. And then when your kid's having a rough day, they can say, I'm having a rough day, mom, and I just need to cry. Okay, then let's cry. It's okay. Right. We can do that, right?
Moms have feelings too. And it helps the kids to not take that on themselves. Oh, mom's sad because something happened at work, not because I'm a bad kid.
Right? Exactly. Yes. Yes. Creates that understanding and learning. So this has been a great conversation, and I love everything that you're doing. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience? Anything else you want to highlight or share about what you do and why, and any words of wisdom that you have for our audience today?
I think the big thing is to know you're doing okay. If you're doing it, all of these things, if you are a working parent, you're struggling, you're not alone. I think we all are. And how that's true of whatever work looks like for you. If you're working 2 hours a week or 200 hour weeks right now, you're doing okay. And it's hard because it's hard. And I'd say that you deserve support, right? You deserve to have help and to bring in other pieces of the village, whether that be more childcare or coaching or whatever else would benefit you, that you deserve that to get through this, and that take the time to ask yourself what you want and to see if you can answer that question. Because if you can lead and parent from a place of an alignment, you're just going to be, the journey's going to be easier. It's going to be more comfortable. So I think those are the three things I'd leave everyone with.
I love all of that. And I think as a reminder, and just as a focus, I think understanding that there's so much value in getting that coaching support and finding the right place for you to get that support as an individual for those that are struggling. And then also for our workplace leaders, for those that are in a position to make a shift or a change in terms of the workplace environment, to begin really recognizing that you have a whole person that comes to work. They come to work, that, like I said, your body goes with you everywhere you go. And that person has a series of challenges and opportunities in their parenting and in their life that is outside of the workplace or the work that they're doing in that role. And if you can help them understand how to develop the skill sets that are going to support them in both the workplace and at home, and how to hone those skill sets and apply them in both places, you're actually going to get better performance out of those people. They're going to bring you more value and more results, and they're going to be able to have greater capacity to perform, greater capacity to be able to do more for you if you're supporting them as a whole person rather than trying to just focus on the workplace aspects of who they are. And if people want to get in touch with you, if they're interested in your programs or getting some individual coaching from you, how can they get a hold of you? How can they reach out to you?
Yeah, they can certainly check out my website, which is just drannwelsh.com. And I've got links there to my group coaching program that launches in January called Working Mother's Lifeline, and my individual coaching page as well. They can also find me on Instagram. It's at dr.welsh.coaching. And I'm also on LinkedIn at Dr. Ann Welsh.
So make sure you check out all of Dr. Ann Welsh's offerings. She's phenomenal. She's clearly doing amazing work in this space. And as I wrap up this episode, I just want to remind all our listeners to always keep evolving, always keep growing, keep rewiring those neural pathways so that you can live more and have more exceptional experiences on your life journey, so that one day when you look back on your life, you can say, I truly lived an exceptional life. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week, and we will be back again next week with another episode.